Let's try that again. There we go. Okay. We were talking about grant writing, which is everyone's favorite thing to do, I'm sure. I noticed that right now you've got a couple of R01s and also a Howard Hughes, as well as some other things. So are you in pretty good shape now, or in terms of your funding?
Yeah, I'm not struggling. But since the money has to pay for my salary and everybody else's salary and 30% fringe benefits for everybody else, I have to have this much money in order to just keep an operation of 7 or 8 people employed. And without us always feeling crisis. I have large animal bills because of all the transgenic and the knockout work. So my annual animal bills run upwards of $60,000 to $70,000 a year. So a lot of my grant money goes to that. And although it may seem like I have adequate support, some grants restrict how much personnel they'll cover or what type of personnel they'll cover. Some restrict different categories. And so it came to a point where I had to have these kinds of grants and this much in order to be comfortable. So two NIH grants. The other thing, the thing that's good about that is that if one you lose one, you'll not be perceived as being without, because in many ways your worth is based upon your NIH funding, because they give the most indirect costs to the school. So even for many years when I had no NIH grant, I never was grantless or penniless, but the grants that I had either paid no indirect costs or very small percent. And because of that, it was perceived by my chairman. I was flat out told by my chairman that until I got an NIH grant, I would not be considered to have arrived or, you know, have accomplished, to have the support of my peers. You know, the mark of my peers. And in no way was that true, because all the other grants were peer-reviewed. So what it meant was that I wasn't bringing in enough overhead for the school or for him to be satisfied. So now that I have several NIH grants and other, you know, groups within the school that want to put together program project grants see that, well, okay, she's been able to get several NIH grants. Maybe, you know, she's a strong candidate to add to our program project grant, which will then mean possibly another NIH grant. So that was what the meeting that I had right before this meeting was about, that I, you know, yesterday afternoon was told, today at 1 o'clock, will you come and give a chalk talk about such and such we'd like you in our program project grant? And we're going to go down to NIH on Friday, and we need to, you know, have this meeting now. So, you know, that obviously it's great. It'll be great for me if I can get another, because you never know when one project is going to go dry or you know, you'll lose it or something. So having these fail-safes are good. And the other thing is if you're bringing a lot of indirect costs in, people leave you alone. They're not going to rock your boat too much. And that, you know, in the long run is good.
Well, how do you handle the, you know, the uncertainty? Because, I mean, it's clear from talking with you that it's not easy. How do you you know, how do you deal with the
uncertainty? At times, bad. At times, very bad. I'm sure that that every time you ask this question to any scientist, it has to make people nervous. Anyone that tells you that they deal with it, they take it in stride, it's no problem. I would say it's possible that they're at an institution where their salary is covered. You know, at a state institution, 10 months, some cover 12 months of one's salary. So if you get $150,000 a year from NIH, and that's going to pay salaries in your lab and your grants and your supply money, mm-hmm. that 150 goes a lot further than the 150 for you to pay your salary, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, so it is a big stress, particularly when your salary is hooked up to it. Granted, you know that the school is going to pay your salary if you lose all sources of funding, but it's not going to be forever, and that time period, you're not going to feel, either directly or indirectly, you're not going to feel very comfortable about that. Anyone who does, mm-hmm. well, maybe I need to take some lessons from them, but it has to be, you know, a fine art to learn how to take that in stride. Mm-hmm. So you have to learn how to put it into perspective, because if you don't, it becomes a big stressor. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten better.
Do you require your postdocs to supply their own funding, like Harvey did?
I would
with
love
you?
To. No. Mm-hmm. I try to push them to. A number of them are not Americans, and so mm-hmm. the agencies that they have access to funding from are far fewer. Mm-hmm. NIH is a good source of money for American fellows or people who are permanent residents, mm-hmm. and the funding level is quite high now, but most of my fellows are not American. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that source is out, which makes it more difficult. I have had some who were very aggressive and creative and felt a pride in getting their own funding. And mm-hmm. I've had others that don't seem to be bothered mm-hmm. by the fact that they're not writing grants for mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. I certainly do encourage them to do it, but if I wait around for people to come with their own funding, I won't have many postdocs at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whether that's a reflection of the times or a reflection on where my science is at and where I stand in the grand scheme of things, but I can't demand that mm-hmm. and carry the operation that I want to carry. Mm-hmm.
You talked a little bit earlier about how competitive the field is, and there's no doubt that competition is a major player in the sciences. You talked about some of the downsides of it. Is there any upside to the competition?
Oh, for sure. As well as, you know, in athletics, if it pushes you to do better and to excel, in this case, to potentially to be more creative, to think harder. So there are many, many benefits to it. And, you know, you have to keep it all into keep it in perspective.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people worry about getting scooped on something. Has that ever happened to you?
I've been fortunate. No. I'm the kind of person, have I worried about it? small worry. I don't think you can let it be your obsession, mm-hmm. because that will drag you down. I always have felt and told people that I can't waste my time worrying about what other people are doing. I know that I'm doing good science, that I'm working at the best rate that I can and doing the best I can, and that I feel that if I run my own race and not somebody else's race, that in the end I can't be disappointed with myself. If it wasn't enough to win the race, then so be it. I ran the best that I could, and I did the best that I could. And by not looking over my shoulder and worrying where other people are at, I'm not burdened with that. And I see a lot of other people that are too busy looking over their shoulders, calling around, trying to snoop out where others are at, and then you get hyper and obsessed, mm-hmm. with, you know, where you are relative to them. Even if you know that it turns out that you're far ahead, then what? What would the reflex for that be? I would think it would be more natural that you would ease up and say, I could take it easy a little bit. We're far ahead. Ha! You could turn around and find out that that they made a giant leap forward and now they're ahead of you. So don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Run your own race. So I put my blinders on, and as one of my very close friends has said to me, you are one of the most no-nonsense kind of people I know. And so I run my race, I do it my way, on my terms, and I don't mess around. Mm-hmm. So I haven't been unlucky in that I've gotten scooped on a big thing. There was a point when I was a postdoc where one of the stories that we were working on, we submitted to Science, and the paper got sat on for a period of about 3 months.
By the magazine? By the journal?
By a reviewer. And we were calling and calling and calling, mm-hmm. and they said they were still waiting for one of the reviewers to get back, and waiting, and we felt it was an extraordinary amount of time. And what happened was, we woke up one morning, opened up Nature, and saw two papers come out in Nature that essentially had the story that we wanted to publish that was being sat on, mm-hmm. in Science. So at that point, we got a lovely letter from Science, and the manuscript returned to us saying that in light of the two papers that had come out in Nature, that this was no longer of global importance, and that it was more suitable for a specialty journal. Mm-hmm. So it was clear that somebody, probably one of the authors of the other papers, was the ones that was sitting on it, because what had come back, they were not damning reviews. They were reasonable things that we could have easily answered, and we would have had a more timely publication. So I guess you could say we got scooped there. I never viewed it so much about being scooped as much as cheated, mm-hmm. in a way. But I mean, it happens. Yeah. So we just quickly reformatted the paper, sent it to the JBC. It got accepted so fast and was soon published after it. So we weren't penalized, mm-hmm. more than the paper came out in a different journal and it took a few more months. Mm-hmm. It was a little disappointing, but...
Well, that brings up, though, the darker side of competition.
Yeah.
Which is doing things that are not so nice on the better end.
Yeah.
And doing things that could be considered even fraudulent at the other end of the extreme. And in your career, have you run into any sort of ethical problems in the field of science?
Of course. Yeah.
Anything you want to talk about?
My experiences have been more as an observer, mm-hmm. or being asked to judge, mm-hmm. where I had been recruited by the Committee on Ethics here to review at two points in my career cases that had been brought forward. One was a very, I think it was sort of an innocent, minor infraction. It was an NSF grant proposal. There was a paragraph that had been in a grant proposal that was plagiarized from a review article. And probably the person who wrote the review article is the one that reviewed the grant, and that's why it even got picked up. Mm-hmm. And a really big stink was made over it. The paragraph was not even an important paragraph. It was in the background in significance. It wasn't even that. If that paragraph were removed from the document, the importance of the subject was still there. Mm-hmm. This isn't to say that I advocate copying somebody sure. else's work and not crediting them for it. What it turned out to be was a senior postdoc in the lab who was a co-investigator on the grant. The grant really was this person's grant, but because this person wasn't an independent faculty member, this person couldn't put the grant in themselves. So this faculty member who had the lab and was sort of the mentor of this mm-hmm. very senior postdoc / instructor signed off on the grant and had read everything over, but really had no way to know that paragraph in the background in significance was copied from a review article. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was copied with the citations, each sentence, you know, that cited the fact that mm-hmm. was, you know, being made in that sentence and referenced. And so for the senior investigator, I don't know how this person could have ever known where that paragraph came from and why you would assume that it had come from someone else's review article that was copied by, you know, your mm-hmm. protege. Is, you know, beyond me, but the task that the committee had was to figure out, you know, whether this was done intentionally, you know, who was at fault, what punishment, mm-hmm. if any, should be made, and we were told that we had to come to some kind of decision, and the decision better be a good one, because otherwise NSF would come in and investigate it themselves. We don't want, you know, NSF to think that that at Einstein we don't have a way of dealing with these things quickly and properly and fairly. So I looked at the situation and I sat back and I said, I don't know how I would ever have picked this up. Someone in my lab could easily dupe me and I could be accused of the same thing, because they were pointing the finger more at the senior person mm-hmm. than the one that did it. And the one that did it admitted, I did it, English isn't my first language, it must have been my way of taking notes and that I was copying, and then when I started putting the whole document together, I didn't realize that that was a verbatim quote and blah, blah, blah. It seemed pretty reasonable. Mm. The person was sorry. We couldn't find any other evidence within that document or any other document. Mm. And it occupied five faculty from here, plus a parent committee with another five or so faculty for several months. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, really, the slap on the hand that the senior investigator got, where a letter was placed in her file, the fact that the letter didn't go beyond the file, couldn't be made accessed by just anyone, was, to me, the fact that there was a letter anywhere, I thought was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Because you never know what these pieces of paper can be used for. Mm-hmm. And it really was, it was something where you could see it was making this woman crazy, mm-hmm. treating her like a criminal. So that was one experience that I had as an assistant professor. That opened my eyes up and made me realize I could get into so much trouble with the people that I employ and that I'm mentoring. If they want to be diabolical, they can trick me and I won't know it, and then I'm going to be pulled on the carpet. So that made me realize that, you know, aspects of my own job and my job responsibilities that I hadn't even thought of. And then as an associate professor, 2 years ago, I sat on another committee that was just really an ugly relationship between two people for a very long time, and each one was doing, you know, more and more and more detrimental things to the other, and so it was misconduct on multiple levels by both parties, and that to me was also disgusting, taught me another lesson. I could see where it could happen in any walk of life, not just in science. So both of them weren't the hardcore kind of cheating, making up data mm-hmm. issues. Where that, and then when I was a postdoc, there was the big thing with David Baltimore, Teresa Imanishikari, and the Dingle investigations, and as a postdoc at Whitehead, I remember we invited someone from Dingell's office who was going to be writing legislation to protect whistleblowers, and David invited this person down to Whitehead and wanted a small group of students and postdocs to meet with this person to discuss issues. And I was asked to talk to this person within the group. And I think it was because when I cloned GLUT4, my stuff was publicized in newspapers and whatever. So the people that were brought in were one, postdocs and students that were brought in were ones that had experienced, let's say, some degree of visibility at the time. And I guess I was, at that point, I was answering questions or thinking about scientific misconduct and actually making up data when I had never even, like, the thought of doing that never crossed my mind. It would be something that maybe science fiction, mm-hmm. you would write in science, a science fiction novel, but not that science is really the fiction of some, you know, scientist that publishes it. Right. And so it made me think a little bit more about, you know, actual fantasy of data and how dangerous that can be and et cetera. I did have a man that had come from China to work in my lab as a visiting scientist when I was a junior faculty member. And it turns out he came from sort of a privileged environment. His parents were communist leaders. I didn't know this. Mm-hmm. On his CV, he had gone to medical school, then went on to do endocrinology and metabolism. he wrote and he told me that he wanted to do research in that area after having been, you know, in more of a clinical setting. Mm-hmm. He went to a medical school that someone else in my lab had gone to, and this person in my lab knew him, another person from Einstein knew him, and so I thought that I had someone that, even though I couldn't interview, mm-hmm. that was a reasonable person to bring over. And what became clear to all of us after he got here was that things were handed to him on a silver platter, and everything he got was sort of through the back door throughout his life. And suddenly, that wasn't happening here. And he couldn't get things to work, and then he started making things work. Suddenly, I was getting very clean, like unbelievably clean results. Things where he would have to take scintillation counts and then make a graph from it. And the numbers were just too perfect. You know, when you're drawing the best fit line, very often, most of the points don't actually land on the line. They're scattered around it. Well, he had most of the dots on the line, and it would be rare that a dot wouldn't be on the line. And because it was so uncreative, his way of fixing the data, I was queuing into it very quickly. So then I would ask him for the primary data, mm-hmm. and he would say that he left it at home, or he was on the bus and he lost it on the bus, but he hopes to find it, and all these weird excuses. And you know, I started pointing out to him that he would show me primary data, and I would show him, well, the data isn't exactly this, you see. And then he would say, well, I wanted to make it look good because I want you to be happy. And I said, well, I'm happy to know what the data is. I'm not happy to have you make up what you think will make me happy. And he couldn't cut it, and so he would just try to make the data be what he thought it should be. Mm-hmm. And I felt that was way too dangerous a situation. So I essentially told him that the funding source ran out for him. I'm not good at firing people. And so I will endure a lot of pain before telling someone to go. And so my way of getting this guy out of the lab was to tell him that the funding source ran out. But actually, he was exhibiting a lot of strange behaviors, that he was talking to himself, he was pacing all around the lab, he was making everyone in the lab really, really, really nervous. And people would see him, like, walking on the streets at, like, 2 o'clock in the morning, just seemingly aimlessly. And when I asked him if something was bothering him, this is before I told him that the funding ran out, he said that his father, back in China, was dying, had a bad heart and everything. And so I told him, well, I think you should go back to China and be with your father. What really was going on, what I found out then from Chinese community members here later, was that he was imagining that his wife was having an affair back in China, and he didn't want to tell me that, but he felt that if he told me he was worried that his father was dying, that that would be reasonable cause for his behavior. Mm. But instead he was really worried that his imagining and getting furious mm-hmm. over the fact that he thought his wife was having an affair back in China, and it was driving him nuts here. And, you know, several people in the lab came and said to me, you know, this guy is such a nut. I think he's going to come in one day, and he's going to blow us all up. He's going to just take out like a machine gun and blow us all up. And, well, I think right around the same time, a Chinese student somewhere in the Midwest, I think in Wisconsin or Iowa, I think he was a physics student, lost his composure and shot his mentor, like, right between the eyes. And I think, you know, either he failed out of the program mm-hmm. or something, and then, you know, that scene is such a disgrace. So you can't go back mm-hmm. to China, and or you'll be viewed as a failure. And he couldn't accept that, and this guy, like, offed his mentor. So, you know, this was sitting in everybody's head, and people in the lab were antsy that the guy was going to lose it. And I knew he was making data up, and now I'm thinking, how am I going to fire him? I got to get him out of here. So I told him that I would pay him for a month, but the money was going to run out, and that I didn't expect him to work during that month, that he should spend the time trying to find alternate employment, but that I couldn't give him a recommendation for here. I said, you should look elsewhere. But he liked living in the postdoc housing here, the cheap rent. There was a large Chinese community. So he kept looking here. And I said, Bo, I'm going to have to be outright honest and tell people I do not recommend you for here. I have to live with these people, and you are making up data. So then he said he would never do it again. And I said I couldn't risk that, and that he should look elsewhere. So he came to me. I was never forget, I was writing a grant, and I was in my office, and it was like a Saturday night, around 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was all by myself, and I was pretty sure that I had locked the lab door, but I had my office door inside open. And at 2 o'clock, he appears, and he just starts crying like a baby, throws his body on the floor, wraps his arm around my ankles, and he's like sniveling on my feet, begging me to take him back. He'll never, you know, manipulate his data again. He'll be wonderful, blah, blah, blah. Was so frightening, because he was you know, very acting so strange mm-hmm. At that time, and I had learned through my technician that he really, you know, as much as he was saying it was his father that was sick, he thought his wife was having an affair. So I knew that this was, I didn't know where reality began or ended with mm-hmm. him, but I knew that he was a scientific liability. And I had to stand by, there's no money. I said, there's no money. You have to go. But please give me a recommendation for here. No. I said, and you must leave, or I'm going to have to call security. It's very late. I'm tired. I can't. No is no. And stop crying on me. I said, stand up and act like a man. I said, I cannot take this crying at my feet, and you're wetting my shoes. I was going to say, and you're scaring the living daylights out of me. So after that, after I got him out the door and I locked the lab, and then I locked myself in my office, I then called security. And I, from that moment on, I kind of had a system set up with security that they, until they changed the lock on the lab door, that if I called, they had better be there, like, in a nanosecond, because this guy was just a nut. Mm-hmm. So after that, he ultimately applied for a job at Sloan Kettering. And I wrote a recommendation letter that it was very level. I said what he learned in my lab. I said he required a lot of supervision, a lot of guidance, but that if he had to do the same thing again and again and again, and his data was carefully monitored, that he could be useful. So this was a junior faculty who then called me up and was asking me all kinds of questions, and I said something along the lines that you have to have him do something that's kind of like a well-trained monkey. The same thing again, 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 and you must monitor the data. I didn't say he had fantasized data, but I in no way gave him a glorious review, and I pretty much said he's not a postdoctoral fellow. He requires a lot of supervision. Be careful. I think he lasted 3 months and the guy fired him, and then I heard he was in the import-export business. So that was much better for his perhaps with his ethical background.
Well, see, what's interesting to me is that, you know, you go through all these years of training yourself to become a scientist. You get no training on how to manage a lab and the people in it.
Or the finances
of it.
Or
the finances.
Right.
Yeah.
But actually, for me, the management of the finances, because I know a lot of people who keep bankrupting their labs. Even if they have an adequate source of money, they just, like, spend too much mm-hmm. at one period of time and not enough at others. So they're like, they have no clue about mm-hmm. how to regulate the flow of dollars. And very few scientists take courses in money management or right. economics. But to pay my tuition at Queens College, I took a job, started the day after I graduated high school, at the Greenpoint Savings Bank, and became a teller at the bank. And every summer I worked 6 days a week, earning as much money as I could as a bank teller. And during the school year, I worked on Saturdays. And if I could work, you know, one day or half a day during the week, I did that. I did it all through my undergrad and halfway through graduate school. Mm-hmm. And actually, the bank was trying to get me to become go into the management track there. Mm-hmm. But for me, that was simply to help pay my tuition
right.
and living expenses so that I would be contributing to my family's, the household mm-hmm. Finances and be independent financially. So I learned a lot about how to write out deposit slips, how to keep track mm-hmm. of your balance with things, and that helped me. In the economic aspects of this, and also bargaining with the different vendors to mm-hmm. cut deals. That's something you have to learn how to do too, cutting sure. deals for supplies and pieces of equipment, mm-hmm. etc., and bidding, getting one to bid against another, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. well, you know, look, I can get the same thing from that person and they're going to throw in this on top of it. What are you going to do to make me want it from you? Mm-hmm. So that's a way to help your finances if you're on a low budget, how to make it go better. So if you're able to spend efficiently, mm-hmm. that's good. And they don't teach us that. Mm. Yeah, so there are an awful lot of things. They don't teach us how to manage people. Lots and lots of things that we have to do. You just get thrown into, mm-hmm. and it's kind of strange. A lot of other careers prepare people for a lot of what they're really going to do mm-hmm. on their job, and we don't get that. Mm-hmm. And what you learn actually is that a lot of our job is political science.
Right.
Too. And we don't get any training in that. Most scientists by nature are poor politicians. Right. So you have to learn that too, mm-hmm. that, you know, diplomacy, etc.
And then the real irony is that when you're done doing all of this stuff, there's no time to be at the bench.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's why I think the beginning part of your career is the hardest. Mm-hmm. Or the beginning part of your independent career is the hardest. When I was finishing my postdoc, Lodish said something to me that I didn't appreciate fully at the time and didn't want to believe. Mm-hmm. He said, you are right now at the best time in your career, and you're about to begin the worst time in your career. The two are directly, you know, abutted next to each other. During your post time, during your postdoc time, that's the best time of your career. When you're an assistant professor, at least for the first few years, it is the absolute worst time of your career. And a lot of postdocs that had recently left the lab and, you know, were coming back or communicating with people back at the lab were talking about how great life after the Lodish lab was, how happy they were in their own labs, and how great, everything was great, great, great. I came here, and I'll never forget, you know, getting bombarded with a million things at once. Yeah, they built a beautiful lab for you, but engineering didn't quite finish the job. Now they're starting another job. So getting the last few things, yeah, you know, yeah, done, that's like the rate-limiting step. Never going to get past those things. And you're new at the place. You don't know what buttons to push. You don't know the path of least resistance. And for the first time in my life, I started getting migraine headaches. And then you realize, hey, this is beautiful. This is my lab. Isn't it great? And then you hear an echo. Because you're all alone in your lab. Oh, holy mackerel, I'm all alone. I got to get people here. I'm great. Look at the great job I did as a postdoc. Why aren't people flocking to my lab? And so you go through this period of denial that you're a junior faculty member, and let's face it, when I went looking for a postdoc, I wasn't looking at assistant professors, people who were just getting started, you know. So I'm thinking that I'm going to attract postdocs who were like me to my lab. And I couldn't understand, why aren't these people banging down my door? Why, you know, where is everybody?
Yeah.
And you realize how many hats you have to wear at the same time. You have to recruit the people. You got to write the grants to pay their salaries. You have to then train them. You have not just train them to do things, but train them, you know, to function independent of you, which takes a long time. Then hope that they can start asking questions that are useful, as opposed to how long do I have to keep this at this temperature? Mm-hmm. And they have a protocol in their hand that says 20 minutes at 37 degrees. You know, so it's, I saw Harvey, I think that I had seen him, or I had to call him for some reason. It must have been about a year after I was gone, or close to a year after I was gone. And I said, Harvey, I have to be very honest with you. And he said something like, Maureen, I don't think you've ever been anything but honest with me. I said, you know, when I was getting ready to leave your lab, you made a comment to me that this was the best, the postdoc time is the best time in your career. And it's immediately followed by the absolute worst time in your career, when you're beginning as an assistant professor. And I didn't want to believe that you were right. And several postdocs who had left the lab and were only gone for, you know, a short period of time were all talking about how great life after the Lodish lab was, and everything was smelling like roses and peaches and cream and glorious. They were lying through their teeth. I said, you were right. This is the worst time. I get migraine headaches. How many things do I have to do at once? Oh, my God. He goes, I told you, Maureen, I really meant it. So yeah. it's true, and you're doing so many jobs. It's not even that you're doing so many jobs you were trained to do, and suddenly you have to do them simultaneously. You're doing the thing that you were trained to do, but then on top of it, you have to learn how to do all these other things that you weren't. Mm-hmm. And then you start realizing that as you're successful in growing within the lab, that the thing that you enjoyed the most, which was the bench work, you can't do it all.
Okay. Well, I think we'll wind it up for today, and we'll continue tomorrow.